Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. This is the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum. One thing you may not know about me, I was married to my lovely wife in 2006, January 13th. It was actually Friday the 13th in the Idaho Falls Temple. Shout out to Idaho, but I digress. In this episode, we talk with an author of When Mormons Doubt, A Way to Save Relationships and Seek Quality of Life. So if you as a leader are interacting, or, and if you haven't, you will at some point, with somebody who is going through a faith transition, a faith crisis, you will realize soon enough that that is affecting their relationships with the other members of their family or the members of the ward or even the leadership yourself in the church. And so this is a great resource, a great topic to help you through that so that everybody's blessed and we can focus on the grace of Jesus Christ. So here's my interview with John Ogden. Today, I have the opportunity to chat with John Ogden. How are you, John?
Great, thanks.
Good. Well, no, the first time I came across your name was in the Salt Lake Tribune. You wrote an article about Sad Heaven. I should have the article in front of me so I could name the title specifically. But how long ago was it that you wrote that article?
I think it's been 2.5 months now.
Great. And have you gotten pretty good feedback on that? Good dialogue going? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there were like 1,400 comments on the piece. Awesome. And then, yeah, there's lots and lots of people reaching out to talk about it. Most of them positive, from what I could see, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is, I don't know if I'd call it a controversial topic, but it's sticky. You know, it's a little uncomfortable for people, but I just pulled it up here. It said that the title was Belief in Sad Heaven Hurts Relationships in Era of Mormon Doubt. And this, I guess, is sort of a springboarding off of a book that you recently wrote called When Mormons Doubt, A Way to Save Relationships and Seek a Quality of Life. Are those, did the book lead to the op-ed, or is that something you just submitted to the Tribune, or how did the article come to be?
The article came to be, I initially posted a piece on a website called Medium, and it approached the topic of Sad Heaven from a different angle. And the article got such a big response. I think there were like 18,000 views or so just pretty quickly that I thought, oh, well, maybe this is a bigger topic than I had assumed. And so I reached out to the Salt Lake Tribune and said, hey, you know, could I write an article about this topic? And it's a different article that I wrote for the Tribune just about the same topic of this concept of Sad Heaven.
Yeah. So how would you sum it up? Obviously, people can go to the article and I'll link to it where they can read the article, The Belief in Sad Heaven. But how would you sum up this concept of Sad Heaven? Because before I read this article, it wasn't really a name that I had, or a title or a subject that I had read before.
Sure. So the basic idea is that sometimes within Mormonism and in many other religions as well, we can get so concerned about the specifics of the afterlife as they relate to somebody who disagrees with us, that we create this concept that I term in this article, Sad Heaven, where we think, oh my word, these people who I love, who no longer believe the way I do, aren't going to be with me when I go to heaven. And that makes me sad. And so what that does, I argue in this article, is that it often can hurt your relationships right now. If you're always sad when you think about that person and how they won't be with you in heaven, it can create this divide or this gap between the two. And that can be really damaging over, you know, a decade, 2 decades, 4 decades. You know, how long can you hold that belief, and how does that sour the relationships that you have today? And I think needlessly so, because there's just so much that we don't know about how God, you know, in his infinite wisdom and I would say infinite mercy, has in store for all of us.
Yeah. And the typical situation may be, maybe there's a, you know, a family of five children and two parents are very active. And then later on, maybe one of those children comes across some, you know, experiences some doubt, a faith transition, and decides to remove themselves from the church. And I almost think that those parents or those siblings do it unintentionally, but, you know, maybe around Thanksgiving, the mother would whisper to that person that, oh, we're praying for you and we hope that you come back, or even that they go through a time of depression where they think, man, there's an empty seat in heaven now. And, you know, and then the relationship becomes defined by that, right?
That's right. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. When the relationship becomes defined by difference, I think that can often be unhealthy for the relationship.
What from your past, like, have you had experienced this sad heaven yourself, or where did this come through where you thought this is a topic to actually write a book on?
So I think that the concept first hit me when my younger sister left the church, and she had studied world religions at Utah Valley University. And she just decided that religion wasn't palatable to her anymore. And when she left, a lot of people in our family and, you know, friends were sad about this. And part of the reason was because they were worried about her faith in the afterlife and her fate in the afterlife and what that would mean for them. And I had to wrestle with this because at the time she was going on to get her PhD in chemistry. And from my perspective, she was very successful. So it created this dissonance, I guess, where it's like sometimes in the church we can get this myopic view, which says that when somebody leaves, then they are automatically a failure. And success, on the other hand, is like when all your kids go on missions, when all your kids get married in the temple, when all your kids have grandchildren. And so we can kind of get this dichotomy where we say these things equal success, and if you don't do these things, then you are a failure. And so it was when my sister left the church that I was really wrestling with this idea. And I increasingly came to the conclusion that worrying about the details of the afterlife wasn't a good thing to add to that mix, because again, there's just so much that we don't know about how God's plan will work out for his children, mm-hmm. that having anxiety over those issues seems irrelevant at this point.
You hit on an important concept of we sort of make assumptions about heaven, about the geography of heaven, about the details of heaven, you know, where, how people will live. And there is this concept that's come up through doctrine somehow that, you know, being together, you know, the common phrase of being together forever or being a forever family sort of means that, well, there'll be this, this area where only people who have been sealed can go. And if right. you're not sealed, that means, oh, they can't go there. And through my studies, I've really, and I may be wrong here. I don't know. I'm open if a listener has, you know, a talk or something that describes this better, but nowhere in my studies have I found that this doctrine means there's a physical separation, or, you know, that they'll just be on this far out place that, you know, suffering to some degree. But, you know, we really don't know that. And it makes me think of the time I was bishop, and from time to time I'd get somebody coming in. Generally the situation was they had been divorced, but though they were legally divorced, that on the records they were still sealed to their ex-spouse, and they would be so caught up in the worrying about, you know, well, I'm still sealed to this person. We've got to cancel that. I cannot imagine being with this person forever. And I always look at them like, do you really think like heaven's a place where because you're sealed, because you have this ordinance that you're going to be forced to live with these people? Like that's not how I see the gospel. And nothing tells me that that's the way it is. And so on the other hand, we sort of create the same perspective with the sad heaven thing that we think, well, if somebody doesn't hold up to all their covenants, that they're going to be cast out and we'll never even be able to see them. They'll just be this distant memory. But again, I don't really think that that's a great foundation to build on when you're trying to build these relationships. And I love that point that you're trying to say, let's not worry about the details of heaven, but really figure out how to love them here and now.
Right. So one way that I contrasted that view of sad heaven with another view is looking at, and this might sound silly, Mr. Rogers.
Oh, yeah.
So Mr. Rogers, you know, I watch his show now with my son.
I was a big fan as a child as well.
Yeah, so. he's so fantastic. And he says, consistently, he says, "I like you just the way you are." And that's kind of a nerve-wracking concept when you're dealing with a child that you say, or a child that you say might be wayward. But there's something powerful about this idea. And so on the one hand, you can say, you know, I'm really disappointed in this child and I can't believe that I'm no longer going to be with them in heaven. And you can create all this anxiety in your life about your narrative of the afterlife. Or you can try to internalize that concept from Mr. Rogers of figuring out how to love them as they are. And at first, I think people might be resistant to that concept because they might think, oh, if I love them as they are, then they might think that I'm condoning their sinful behavior or, you know, any number of things. But I consistently find that the opposite is true, that when you really love somebody the way that they are and they can feel that love, they want to live a better life. They want to be more generous. They kind of feed off that love in a way that is ultimately really positive. And so I would say that if you're faced with the option of being consumed with these thoughts of failure and anxiety about sad heaven, you're better off to follow that lead that, in this case, Mr. Rogers says, learn how to love them the way that they are.
Yeah. And the opposite of that, that you kind of measure that against is the Pascal's wager. You call it Mr. Rogers' wager. And is it Pascal? Is that how you say that?
Yep. Uh-huh, that's right.
Pascal's wager, where he was sort of looking at eternal progress, a practical way. It's the thing, well, my best bet is to believe in God and, you know, try and be a good Catholic. And if, as long as I do that, the chances are with me that if there is a God, then he'll bless me for believing in him. If there isn't a God, well, we're all dead anyways, and it doesn't matter. Right. And we sort of do the same version of our own in our own theology of by saying, well, if I can just get everybody sealed in my family, and that sort of locks us in, and then we don't have to worry about anything else. And because we know that the truth is there and we'll be fine. But we're sort of wagering against eternal ordinances, which are very valid and important, but we forget the process of sanctification in there, where we're sort of just focused on the justification. If we can just get our family justified, we're there, but we forget that we have to get them sanctified. And that comes through, you know, sanctification comes through Mr. Rogers' wager, where we look at people and say, you know, I love you just the way you are, even though you don't believe like me, even though you're not, you know, in the church, I'm going to love you just the way you are. And there's so much of a richer relationship we get from that, which in turn makes us more like God, which is really what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the way that you talked about that. And in those moments where I do internalize this concept of loving people the way they are, I do feel closer to God. And so to me, that's a sign that it is, godly. I keep thinking of the scripture in First Nephi, when Nephi says, "I know that he loveth all his children. Nevertheless, I do not know the meaning of all things." And so, again, there's so much that we don't know about how everything's going to work out. But if we can keep focused on this idea that God loves his children, and if we can emulate that in our lives, he loves all his children. And as Jesus says, he says that he causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. Everyone can receive that love from God. And that is something that I think that we can internalize in our own lives.
Yeah. And, you know, the reason I want to spend some time on this is, as bishops listen or leaders in the church listen, I know that they're getting these questions, or they're seeing families maybe in their ward that are sort of being torn apart because somebody is leaving. And so, you know, if the bishop has an opportunity to bring them in or bring that a sad mother that's experienced their wayward child, and just kind of remove that anxiety a little bit and saying, listen, let's not make assumptions that because this person's making this decision that you'll literally never see them or interact with them in the afterlife. We simply right. don't know that. And it was interesting as I was, we were emailing back and forth, and I read your article in the Tribune and started reading in your book. I was, in my personal study, I was sort of like, where does this concept come from of these details of heaven that if we're not sealed to somebody, or if somebody's not righteous, then they'll be cast out from us. And I really couldn't find much, but then I was preparing, unrelated to that concept, I was preparing for a home teaching lesson in the August Ensign of 2016. There's the first presidency message is titled "The Hope for Eternal Family Love," and it's written by President Eyring.
Right.
And near the end, he says, "A prophet of God once offered me counsel that gives me peace. I was worried that the choices of others might make it impossible for our family to be together forever. He said, 'You are worrying about the wrong problem. You just live worthy of the celestial kingdom, and the family arrangements will be more wonderful than you can imagine.'" And I thought, man, what a fantastic message that a leader could deliver to a family member and say, "You are worrying about the wrong problem, because the family arrangements will be more wonderful than you can imagine." And that brings such peace to my heart as I think of individuals in my family that have made choices that maybe disqualify them from certain ordinances and such, that I think will be, and that this is just maybe an opinion towards all of that encompasses the grace of Jesus Christ, that we will be shocked how much grace we are shown by Jesus Christ. And this is a great concept of doing that. And so I think it's just something that worth talking about, of saying that we've got to help our ward members get away from this false doctrine of that we won't, that we understand how the details of heaven works, because we really don't. So, Jeff, where is the book available? Is this, I think it's just on Amazon, right? Or did you have a publisher? Is it self-published?
I self-published it, and it is on Amazon.
Okay. But you go into these concepts of beauty, goodness, and truth. And this gets a little more deep, I feel like, and isn't necessarily something you learn just on the surface. But how would you articulate this idea of the beauty, goodness, and truth?
Sure. So this relates actually to what we were talking about just barely, where I'm interested in carving out a new definition of success. Because if you keep that version that I talked about before, where you're only successful if all your kids go on missions, and you're only successful if all your kids get married in the temple, then we're bound to be disappointed at some stage, right? We're bound to say like, oh, well, these kids are successful and those kids aren't successful. And that can really damage relationships again. So I'm looking at carving out common ground between believers and doubters and those who have left, and saying, you know what? The common ground is the pursuit of a quality life. Now that's pretty vague. And so I break it down into, well, what does a quality life look like? And I say that a quality life is when you're fully invested and in pursuit of finding truth, beauty, and goodness. And this is an old concept. It comes from Plato, and it was carried through different philosophers through time. And it's about the balanced pursuit of these ideals, recognizing that we'll never fully attain these ideals because they're so grand. There's just so much to learn. But it's another way to put it is it's about working on thoughts, feelings, and actions, or the head, the heart, and the hands. So these are the components of finding and pursuing a quality life. Now, what can happen sometimes is that when people start doubting, they are wrestling at intellectual level. And so they get really concerned about finding historical truths, about wrestling with different ideas and concepts. And sometimes in that pursuit of just narrowly focusing on finding the truth, they might lose some of their grip on pursuing beauty and goodness. And so to those who might be doubting, I think that this concept is useful to just like check your spiritual health and check how you are serving people around you. Because while wrestling with intellectual ideas is important, and I think it's something that we need more of, we can't do that at the neglect of pursuing beauty and goodness. So that's just one of many examples of how this idea can be useful.
Something I took away from your book that I so much appreciate is this idea of finding beauty, goodness, and truth in the church and appreciating it. Because I feel like the culture of the church, we've built this culture around truth, right? That we want to be the person that can stand up and say, I know the church is true, but we've rarely been encouraged to say, I know the church is beautiful and I know the church is good.
Right.
But I feel like those are so important. And it takes me back to an episode. It'll be released before we release this one, where I interview when I was a bishop, one of my second counselor, you know, within the last year since we've been released from that bishopric, he's left the church. And I actually interview him on the podcast. And we talk about this concept and you really helped me articulate a little bit better, because what he was doing, what led him out of the church, which he's now sort of regretting, not fully, but he realized it may have been a mistake, but he was so focused on the truth, so focused on getting a strong conversion or a strong message from heaven saying the church is true. Joseph Smith was true, you know, even though he's wrestling with some of these historical concepts. Mm-hmm. And as I was interacting with him as his bishop, I wasn't sure what I was doing, but I was sort of trying to say, I don't know. I feel like I was trying to focus too much again on that truth, saying, you know, I don't know why you haven't gotten your answer yet, but you know, stick with it. But I feel like if members step back and instead say, you know what, for 6 months, I'm not going to worry about the truth side of the gospel, but I'm going to worry about the beauty of the gospel. I'm going to worry about the goodness of the gospel. And even in our testimony meetings, if we encourage people not just to stand and testify of truth, but feel free to stand and testify about the beauty of the church. And as we record this on the week of General Conference, there's something beautiful about the community that happens during General Conference, right? That, I mean, everybody comes out, you go downtown Salt Lake and it's an experience. And even online things are happening, right? There's something beauty in that. And nothing's linked to truth in that per se.
Right.
But it's beautiful. And I feel so privileged to be a part of that, regardless of what historical facts are. It's amazing to be a part of that. And then the goodness, you look at the home teaching program. What a good, fantastic program. Regardless if it's based on truth, there's something about visiting individuals in their home monthly and just letting them know their love. That is such goodness. You know. So I'm carrying on here, John. I forget.
No,
I apologize. But I feel like this just helped me so much as I approach individuals that are doubting, of just saying, because I don't know, I feel like we have this knee-jerk reaction in the church saying, okay, well, just keep praying about it, fast a little bit more, and that answer will come. But instead asking them, well, just take a break from that a while and focus on the goodness of the church and just go serve and be a part of that community, right?
Yeah, I love everything that you're saying there. To pay attention to the spiritual health and to really be focused, like, am I healthier spiritually? And then also, like you're talking about home teaching, like, are my feet on the ground doing things for other people? Mm-hmm. Those are great questions to ask. Now, I think the inverse, I don't know if I would say the inverse, but I don't know how to articulate this exactly, but I would say that there is also a need for more people in the church to be open to the uncomfortable facts about the church. Mm-hmm. So that LDS on LDS.org, they release the essays that cover things like the Seer Stone or the Book of Abraham or Joseph Smith's polygamy.
Yeah.
Sometimes what can happen is that Mormons might focus so much on beauty and goodness that they don't acknowledge that those who doubt have legitimate reasons to be concerned.
Right.
And they just like ignore all of those. They say, you don't worry about any of those things ever. They might say, well, the easiest way that I found to talk about this is with an event with Richard Bushman. And this happened like 3 months ago where he was speaking to a small group and he said,
and just to clear, Richard Bushman is a scholar in the church who's wrote Rough Stone Rolling, a very detailed biography of Joseph Smith, right?
Right. Yep, exactly. It's a great book. And he talks in this event, he talked to a small group of people that were asking him questions. And he said something that he said, the dominant narrative of the church isn't true. And he is still a believer. He still thinks that the church is true, but he says that the dominant narrative. And what that means is that many people in the church have grown up with a view, just going back to what I was talking about how Joseph Smith translated it with the plates. He didn't look into a hat and he didn't have multiple wives, mm-hmm. etc. And he's saying, you know, that dominant narrative that we've been teaching doesn't add up, and we should face those facts that are being put out by on LDS.org. We should say, okay, we acknowledge that there are discrepancies between the way that I'll just speak for myself. Like I didn't know about the hat and the seer stone until I was on my mission, and it was news to me. So I go back to this idea that it's the balanced pursuit of truth, beauty, and goodness, that we can get too focused on any one of them. And we kind of have to step back occasionally and check. And we have to say, like, for instance, am I running away from uncomfortable facts about the church? Mm-hmm. And if so, I probably should change that and be a little more sympathetic to people who are doubting and say, you know what? Yeah, those are difficult issues. Again, going back to what Nephi said, I know that God loves his children, but I don't know the meaning of all things. And just kind of being more comfortable with not knowing everything. And if you can do that, then you can really empathize and sympathize with people who doubt. And that creates the common ground that I think is going to move the Mormon and post-Mormon community upward and be very beneficial for us all.
Yeah. And that's a great point, because I feel like sometimes I fall into that pitfall of, you know, if somebody has a concern in the truth category, I then just default to beauty and goodness and say, well, yeah, but what about, you know, what about the President Monson? I mean, what a good, fantastic individual. I mean, how he's got to be a prophet, you know, and I have a deep conviction that he is. But sometimes we diminish the truth side of things for the individuals are struggling with by kind of pushing the goodness on them, right?
Yeah, and they can feel like you're just completely ignoring them. And that can be really hurtful to somebody who is earnestly seeking the truth.
Yeah, and
it's about that balance.
Yeah, we think we're encouraging them to stay in the church when in reality, we're unbeknownst to us, we're actually sort of pushing them away from the church.
Yeah. Yes.
And another point, I think, and I don't know if you hit this more in the op-ed in the Salt Lake Tribune, but just this idea of sometimes our pride of being in the restored gospel, and you know, we get these convictions of truth and we're there, we've got the secrets of heaven and they're fun to learn about, and then somebody leaves, and then we sort of default to, well, because you're rejecting truth, then most likely your life won't have goodness and most likely your life won't have beauty. But in reality, you know, when we have a loved one that's fallen away, maybe that's a common ground we can start on of saying, you know, we realize you don't go to church, but like, what are you finding in the world? Like, what beauty have you found? And they may have attached themselves to another theology or another way of thinking and say, you know, I feel so at peace in this, you know, when I go hiking and I've put more time into, you know, that recreation. And we can say, well, talk about that. Like, do you feel a connection to God or is it to nature? Like, what's beautiful about that? Right. And I feel like that would help build upon those relationships rather than tearing them down because, oh, well, you've rejected the truth category.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. One thing that I bring up in the book is just story after story of people having spiritual experiences, which I say are beautiful experiences in the book. Yeah. Across the world and all different kinds of beliefs and even non-beliefs. But there is beauty all around. And we can acknowledge that wherever we find it. We don't have to be scared if we find it outside of Mormonism. We can embrace it. And that's really the best way to heal these relationships.
Yeah. I remember on my mission president, in his own conference talking about, he asked the question, if somebody in Asia prayed, to know if, you know, about Buddha or about Buddhism, to know if it was, you know, the true church. I don't, obviously not in that term. That's very LDS jargon, but You know, if he prayed to seek if Buddha was really there, would God testify to them that they were? And he was said, you know, he might, because God is seeing somebody act on faith towards a better thing, a goodness in the world, right? And so we see example of example where the Lord is blessing individuals across the world, even outside of the context of the church, because it's good, because it's beautiful, and that testifies, that leads to him.
And that there might be more there than we can comprehend as Mormons, that God is the God of 7 billion plus people. And that there, we might not, I think one thing that's very helpful is to not be so concerned about interpreting beautiful experiences as proof that your worldview is the correct worldview. There is a place for just experiencing beauty and not worrying about what it means in terms of truth claims.
Yeah.
Because if we can accept that, what happens is that we can get hungry for more and more beauty in our lives, as opposed to, I'm going to be hungry for this period where I'm trying to gain a testimony. And then once I've gained a testimony, I don't need to be as hungry for those profound spiritual experiences. We can keep that hunger with us and we can say, okay, you know, I want to experience more beauty in my life, and I'm not going to tie those experiences to, or I'm not going to be as worried about tying those experiences to saying my religion is the truth and all the other religions aren't. We can kind of leave, we can again be comfortable with not knowing at all the answers, and just be happy with those beautiful experiences.
Yeah. For sure. And I want to read a quick part of a few paragraphs here from your book. And this, I think I may repeat some of the Bushman quote that you gave, but the end of this really made me think. It says, this is on page 94. It says, many Mormons feel that their religion helps them become good in practical ways. I'm thinking of Richard Bushman, who was once asked by a Catholic theologian why he stayed in the church despite knowing so much about its history. Bushman said, I told him I remain a Mormon because when I follow my religion, I became the kind of man I want to be. No philosophy, no evidence, nothing elaborate. Something is simply that the personal reality that my religion helps me get better. That's what it comes down to in the church. There's something to admire in this response. First, Bushman says that this is his personal reality, indicating that he understands that this is not everyone's reality. Second, he earnestly values goodness. If more people were that sincere about wanting to become better, the world would be a more loving place. Bushman's quote also highlights one reason why many active Mormons are sad when people leave. They worry that those who leave will do less good in the world. Is this worry valid? Do people who leave religious communities become the worse for it? Social science shows that the answer isn't simple. But as I read this, I think it's beautiful. I mean, as far as what Richard Bushman says, it speaks so much to why I love this church so much. Not, I mean, and I have had those moments of truth where I felt a conviction that you know, the principles found, the ordinances, the authority are God's authority. I've had that conviction, but nonetheless, even if that, I don't know. I mean, even if that was taken away, there's no arguing that this way of life that I'm striving to lead makes me a better person. And so if anything, that helps me balance the truth and goodness, because when, you know, when I have dissonance in the truth category, I'm able to step back and look at it more broadly and say, well, it's making a better person. So maybe I shouldn't jump to conclusions quite yet about that concern in truth, because everything I'm doing has such beauty and goodness in it. And then the last part where you said the worry about those who leave the church will do less good in the world. And it made me stop and think, like, why do I worry when people do leave the church? And my friend that I mentioned that I interviewed, Heath, he, you know, when he left, when he resigned from the church, I was heartbroken. I was concerned and rightly so. And I don't think, my point isn't that nobody should feel bad when people do, but no, why? I think it's a good question for any leader to ask themselves is, when they see somebody leave the church, why are they sad? Well, maybe they disqualify themselves from ordinances. But those will be there if they come around and have a true look at it. You know, if they're able to correct that truth category, they'll be able to repair that and go through the process again. But it's if they're striving towards what they determine as truth, and it's something that's beautiful and good in their life, like maybe I don't need to be as sad because I know that that'll lead them towards God in just a different way. Am I on the right track there? Am I thinking about this right? What do you think?
So I hope that they do move upward, that anybody who leaves or anybody who stays, that we're all trying to increase in truth, beauty, and goodness. What I worry about in the Utah community, and I don't know a good name for like Mormon and post-Mormon and everything in between, like that community that includes all of these people. Mm-hmm. What I worry about is that many people leave without, and they leave and they just think, okay, now my life is going to be like the opposite of Mormon.
Yeah.
Mormonism. And I think that is really destructive.
Because they run out and get the cup of coffee. They run and try alcohol, or, you know, they try and dabble in these areas that were forbidden. Right.
Right. And it's understandable. So I have empathy for people who take that route, but the reason why I think this concept of truth, beauty, and goodness is so powerful is because it's the common ground between believers and non-believers, but it's also a way to ground us all to say, you know what, even if I decide that I'm going to leave in a formal way, I am still going to hold on to this idea of serving my neighbor in meaningful ways. Yeah. So when somebody is moving in, I am still going to be up and volunteering to help them move in. You know, when somebody has a baby in my neighborhood, I'm going to go and deliver them food and try to take care of them. When somebody's a widow, I'm going to go visit them. So by grounding it in these terms of truth, beauty, and goodness, somebody who leaves can say, you know, I need to be very careful that I don't just let go of everything. That there are still like standards of that lead to a quality life.
Yeah. They sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? And that if the church isn't true, then I don't need to worry about any other moral code or teaching that they ever taught, that's up for question as well. But really thinking, well, I'm going to take the goodness from this. And I think if a bishop's listening and there's somebody who's, you know, they're not going to stay, it's obvious they're leaving, maybe that's some place to start saying, okay, now that you're leaving, what good can you take from this church and continue it, right? What beauty is still there that you can hold on to, even though you're rejecting their truth claims? What can you take from this? And not, because I think that's where, if they don't, they sort of, you know, I've heard many stories of people just sort of spiraling out of control in all areas of their life because they have nothing to anchor to, right?
Right. That's exactly it.
And then they don't recognize themselves after a year and think, oh, well, I don't know what happened, you know? So I think that's a key principle. I was going to mention something along those same lines of, you hear these stories about individuals who have maybe left the church and then later came back, and their story's inspiring. And your book has sort of helped me put it into context a little bit, where it's almost as if some people leave the church because they, one, obviously they have some concerns with the truth claims, but they leave the church because they haven't effectively discovered goodness and beauty in their life. And so by leaving, it allows them to go and discover that goodness and beauty. And then once they've found that and be able to reconcile themselves in those areas, they're ready to come back and reconcile truth as well. And then they're brought back to the church. I mean, that's my hope. And those stories that are told of people leaving and coming back, that's sort of what I feel like is going on there.
Yep. I think that is one narrative that happens. I think that, having said that, we should also learn how to be, and this may be redundant, I might have already said this point, but we should learn how to be okay if somebody never returns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's crucial.
And how to say, you know what, I can accept that God is bigger than I know, or he, you know, there's more going on here than I can comprehend, and I can have trust that things will work out for the best as I work to make them better.
And that's, there's such, you know, you think about the stories of Christ in the New Testament that, you know, when he interacted with sinners, you know, the adulterer and things, there was never this feeling of, you know, there's always encouragement to change and coming to him, but there's never this feeling of, but if you don't, I'm not going to love you. You know, there's always just this abundance of love, regardless of what decision that individual made. And that's, there's such a Christ-like attribute in that. So,
well, John,
I know you're short on time, but just speaking, you know, lots of bishops, Relief Society presidents, individuals that are interacting with people maybe in the midst of a faith crisis, what would they gain out of this book? I mean, you sort of said it already, but why, maybe your last effort to share why they should go check out your book and where they can get it as well.
Yeah. So the easiest place is going to be on Amazon. There are a few stores here in locally in Utah that would have it as well. And I think the biggest thing to get out of it is that if you're interested in understanding why people doubt, I think it's a good book. It doesn't shy away from some of the harder issues about Mormonism and about Christian history, which is another component. So if you're interested in learning why people are doubting in this age of the rise of the internet, it will be useful to understand their doubts and understand where they're coming from and be able to sympathize with their position. And I would hope that for those who are doubting, it will be a way to recognize that, as we've talked about here, that Mormonism has had the church has been working toward goodness for many, many years, and they've come up with a lot of really amazing ways to serve. As we mentioned, home teaching, just really pragmatic ways to help other people. And so I would hope that those who read the book would be able to see how the church has truth, beauty, and goodness, and also areas where we need to improve in our ability to be more honest about historicity and truth, be more honest about where we can improve when it comes to beauty, and be more honest about where we can improve when it comes to goodness. Hopefully it's a way that can bridge and alleviate the tensions between those who leave and those who stay.
That concludes my interview with John Ogden, the author of When Mormons Doubt, A Way to Save Relationships and Seek a Quality of Life. I've really enjoyed this discussion. I'm sure that was obvious during the discussion. I was seemed to be ranting on and on about perspectives, but I just learned so much about myself as I read this of why I believe and why, because it's not always about the church's true, you know, truth principles. It's a lot of that goes to the goodness and the beauty of the church. And by understanding those things, obviously it's, we can better serve those that are struggling in one of those areas, right? And it's interesting, you know, sorry to carry on about this, but there's a lot of people in the church, and maybe you've been in this state where they're not healthy in the goodness and beauty part of the church, right? But they know the church is true, so they stick with it, and they show up to church, and they serve, but they just hate it, right? I don't know. I've heard of individuals like that, and that they just kind of despise going to the war. They're not seeing the beauty of it. And so it's a good time to step back and reflect on how you're well balanced in those three, because that's when the truths, the beauties, the goodness of this gospel, they flourish, and we become better people because of it. So go to leadinglds.org. In the show notes, I will link to this book, and you can check it out and read. And I think it'd be well worth the time. It's not a thick book by any means, 150 or so pages, and so it's something you get through easily in a weekend or short plane ride, whatever it is, when you find time to read. But really well worth it. And John's a great guy, and I'm grateful that we were able to interact, and I hope we get to hear more from John in the Leading LDS world. As always, all we ask is $1 a month for the content that we put out on Leading LDS. And so if you've benefited from this to any measure, I would ask that you take the time today to go to leadinglds.org/help, H-E-L-P, and submit $1 a month or more to what we're trying to accomplish at Leading LDS. I'm constantly striving to find new ways to collect donations, monetize. We're there with the nonprofit. The paperwork's have been submitted. But really, at this point, if it continued to this, it's just unsustainable. And so I definitely need more donations, more people contributing in order for it to continue and to flourish. So leadinglds.org/help, and I would appreciate the help you offer. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.